Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. In 1902, Booker T. Washington commissioned photographer Francis Benjamin Johnston to record students participating in the curriculum at the Tuskegee Normal and Industrial Institute in Alabama. Building on her previous projects in Virginia and Paris, Johnston created some of her most complex work to date on the Tuskegee grounds. On April 29, 2019, as part of the Works in Progress lecture series at the National Gallery of Art, Anjali Leibowitz asserts that Johnston's Learning Dressmaking, Tuskegee Institute, in particular, synthesizes methods of 19th century visual anthropology with discourses surrounding African-American citizenship that had been circulating since before the Civil War.
In 2017, the National Gallery of Art acquired Learning Dressmaking, Tuskegee Institute by Francis Benjamin Johnston, a turn-of-the-century journalist and artist. This 1902 gelatin silver print had been found in her last known residence at 1132 Bourbon Street in New Orleans, Louisiana, strongly indicating that it was in her possession when she died in 1952. From the fourth and final of her surveys at educational institutions, Learning Dressmaking depicts 10 female dressmaking students at the renowned Tuskegee Normal and Industrial Institute, now known as Tuskegee University in Macon County, Alabama. The Institute's founder and first president, Booker T. Washington, seen here, commissioned Johnston, also seen here, to record the school and its curriculum. He had lifted Tuskegee to national prominence through extensive networking, fundraising, and publicity in the North, especially Boston and New York. Learning dressmaking became an integral part of Washington's promotion of the Tuskegee educational model and successful outcomes therefrom. This afternoon, I will discuss learning dressmaking in depth, first connecting it to historical precedents, then Johnston's photographic surveys in Washington, D.C. and Hampton, Virginia, and finally, placing it within the context of Tuskegee itself and Washington's circulation of it. I will not discuss her work at Carlisle Indian Industrial School, though some of you may be familiar with it, due to limited time. In Learning Dressmaking, 10 women align themselves parallel to the picture frame, yet at an acute angle to the chalkboard, doorway, brick wall, and cabinets behind them. Though the students are posed stock still, multiple interlocking pairs of figures create a syncopated movement across the print. Reading the picture from left to right, the theory and process of custom making a dress are revealed, from measuring a client and diagramming a pattern to ironing fabric pieces and sewing them together. Though the process of making a dress is revealed, all but the central figure wears a finished product. It is a depiction of systematic training and the accomplishments that are derived from its skilled application. This is likely why Washington chose to circulate it. Johnston is well known in the fields of photo history and American studies as a progressive era documenter of African American and Native American boarding schools. From 1899 to 1902, she visited and recorded the Washington, D.C. public school system, Hampton Normal and Agricultural Institute in Virginia, which we see here, the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania, and finally Tuskegee. Her 1899 Hampton pictures are by far her most famous works, and they have overshadowed much of her six-decade-long career. The scholarly literature on these pictures of African Americans and Native Americans generally turns on one central question. Why would a white, upper-class woman photograph subjects of different, and it is implied, lesser races? She is alternately credited with oppression open-mindedness and labeled a white supremacist. These questions center Johnston's experience and positionality in the interpretation of these photographs, while also creating a binary relationship of power between photographer and subjects to the exclusion of the institutional context of her commissions. In contrast, my approach to photographs like Learning Dressmaking is an attempt to push at the traditional margins of photo history to expand our accounts to include the volition, the desires, really, of those depicted, as well as their African-American patron, Booker T. Washington, who sought Johnston out, invited her to Tuskegee, and was solely responsible for the publication and circulation of these camera images, namely in the 1903 pamphlet, The Successful Training of the Negro. to follow the lead of an excellent panel on Black Modernisms hosted by our Center for the Advanced Study of Visual Art a few weeks ago, my goal is to, quote, create a polyvocal conversation around a work of art, end quote, one that accounts for the positionality of the artist, the subjects, and the patron. Photographs like Learning Dressmaking have roots in two important historical precedents. The first is scientific. Eminent photo historian Deborah Willis has described Johnston's photographs as a new anthropological mode, and it is true that they have their roots in earlier, much more problematic representations of Black bodies circulated in 19th century scientific societies. The work of French archaeologist and anthropologist Desiree Charnay is a particularly adept comparison to Learning Dressmaking in this respect. In 1863, unable to bypass the Union blockades of the American South to access his Mexican work sites, Charnay photographed women in Madagascar. He posed them in various states of dress, and in an inventive and expedient manipulation of typical anthropological photographic practice, positioned each of the three women at different angles to the camera. Rear, frontal, and profile views of the same subject were generally made by Western anthropologists seeking to establish racial types through the shapes of bodily and facial features. But here, Charnay captures all three views at once, requiring fewer exposures and less time overall. In consequence, Charnay treats these three women as interchangeable. The frontal view of one can stand in for another who offers her profile and vice versa. This method of positioning photographic subjects in a kind of standing tableau is endemic to Johnston's choice of poses for her student collaborators at Tuskegee. Consciously or not, she replicates the anthropological mode to provide thorough study of the students, their self-presentations, and their work. When Washington circulates their likenesses, however, they are counterpoints to the demeaning messages inherent to studies such as Charnay's, with its undertones of the savage and primitive. A second historical precedent for works such as Johnston's is the photographic series of so-called white slaves, produced in the wake of the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863 and sold to raise funds for the foundation of schools in Louisiana. Many of these formerly enslaved children from New Orleans had extremely light phenotypes that made their representation as slaves salacious to Northern abolitionist audiences and funders. With captions such as, "Oh, how I love the old flag," and "Our protection," the American flag becomes an anthropomorphized masculine protector of the delicate children. Their fates are materially entangled with that of the Union. By portraying them as patriotic citizens, the campaign's organizers introduced a new trope to the market of images of enslaved children, of which there were quite a few, moving beyond emancipation and education to citizenship, foreshadowing the debates of the Reconstruction era. At the same time, the pale skin of these children created a safe visualization of the new and uncertain social order to come post-emancipation. These cartes de visite established visual interrelationships amongst race, education, and citizenship, of which Washington would have been all too aware, and that Johnston's photographs elegantly expressed a generation later. It is not only that these cartes de visite are similar in subject matter to the Tuskegee Commission, but also they shared similar circulation patterns, to Northern Quakers to be specific, and a common purpose, to raise educational funds. With this history, Learning Dressmaking has profound import as we attempt to understand its production by Johnston and its circulation by Washington. Learning Dressmaking is by far one of Johnston's most sophisticated photographs in composition and visual storytelling, and it has deep roots in photographic history. It is rare for its beauty, its deep dignity of subject matter, and multivalent interpretive potential, as well as for its positive depiction of African Americans for public consumption in this time period. Outside of private family albums, the dominant visual representations of African Americans were caricatures, anthropological, minstrelsy, and lynching photographs. Indeed, in the mid-1890s, Johnston herself recorded friends participating in the hateful practice of blackface. Operating within a historical context of increased immigration, these pictures argued for a new model citizen that would be trained under the Tuskegee model. Johnston was born in 1864 in Grafton, West Virginia, a state created only 1 year prior when it seceded from the Confederate state of Virginia in the midst of the Civil War. Her family settled in Washington, D.C. in the early 1870s. Her father was head bookkeeper in the Treasury Department, and her mother, also named Frances Benjamin Johnston, worked as a journalist, serving as a Washington correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. In 1883, Johnston left Washington, D.C. for the Académie Julienne in Paris. She trained as a painter, but upon her 1885 return to the Washington area, she turned to her mother's profession, journalism. At first, she illustrated her own articles, but soon turned to photographs, finding them easier and more desirable to a modernizing press. She illustrated articles for activist journalists Jacob Riis and Ida Tarbell. She first made waves on the Washington scene in 1889 with Uncle Sam's Money, an article she authored and illustrated with her own photographs of the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. And I just found this, as a representative, very funny. These paper hats were meant to protect them from dust, but it completely obfuscates their faces. The Washington Post reviewed the article, gushing that Johnston was, quote, a lady of taste and genius, end quote. She developed a professional reputation for gaining access to the upper echelons of the country's power structure, including presidents. If she lacked a direct connection, she often appeared unannounced, flouting formal channels of request. In return, she used her contacts with the New York press to place these portraits in prominent magazines and in many ways shaped how the reading public viewed the inner workings of the federal government. Johnston established her photo studio in 1894 in a custom two-story brick structure behind her parents' residence at 1332 V Street Northwest. From the exterior, we can see that the primary feature of the building is this 12 by 16 foot window, which she manipulated on the interior with a system of elaborate drapery. And she also had a movable camera. Everything could move in there. Her clients were a mix of the fashionable, which we can see here on this beautiful Gibson girl, bohemian and political. The studio was a site of experimentation, play, and societal transgression. Within the arts and crafts influenced decor, Johnston alternately performed the part of upper class business proprietor, hosting teas such as here, as well as vibrant intellectual salons of writers, artists, travelers, and other members of DC's creative classes. On the other hand, she composed self-portraits such as this, in which she cross-dresses and poses with the latest bicycle fad. The latter have been interpreted as proof of her willingness to traverse traditional barriers and tackle subjects that other photographers might refuse, including the Hampton and Tuskegee commissions. Even with such a well-appointed studio, Johnston produced a great deal of her work off-site. Though she could isolate and flatter a portrait subject in a controlled studio environment with the best of them, she also had a knack for contextualizing her subjects within their working and learning environments, as she would in the Washington, D.C. school system, Hampton, Virginia, and Tuskegee. In May 1899, eager to demonstrate what was then called the New Education, the Washington, D.C. school superintendent commissioned Johnston to create a series of photographs that would be displayed at the 1900 Paris Exposition. The nation's capital would represent the country as an innovator in an educational model that tied learning in the classroom to the formation of model citizens and a robust democracy. In 6 weeks, Johnston exposed 700 glass plate negatives, indoors and outdoors, and demonstrated an adeptness for working outside the controlled studio environment with a variety of portrait subjects in myriad circumstances. In this survey, Johnston begins to formulate some basic methods for capturing students in the classrooms and tying specific pedagogical methods to ideas of American citizenship, history, and belonging that she would further develop at Hampton and Tuskegee. Her preferences of a mix of profile, frontal, and rear views for evenly dispersing bodies throughout the picture plane and rich visual context all find their first expressions in this series. Framing the entire project are ideas about how to form a cohesive American body politic, who can be absorbed in that body, and what part each person or group will play, continuing the visual conversation begun during the Civil War. With immigration at an all-time high, the definition of American citizenship was a great source of anxiety and xenophobia during this period. True birthright citizenship was less than a generation old, and the rights to exercise that citizenship fully were constantly under attack, especially for African Americans. images of students saluting the American flag, dressed as the American flag as in the previous picture, in the classroom broadcast a populace unified under a single banner and ideology, while the study of Native American crafts and dwellings, seen here on the chalkboard, this is a cradle, these are the dwellings, and this is a writer. There's also this portrait here that appears in multiple photographs from this series, and I am not sure if it just was in every single classroom or if Johnston carried it around with her. She provided some of her own props. She also owned a lot of Native American artifacts and handicrafts. While the study of Native American crafts and dwellings absorbed the histories of the continent's First Nations, while obfuscating the incredible violence necessary to do so, Johnston's pictures would present an American populace unified visually, if not in reality. A co-educational but racially segregated school system is depicted. Taken just 3 years after the Supreme Court decision of Plessy versus Ferguson, which invented the separate but equal doctrine, Johnston's photographs interestingly show black and white students studying similar subjects, sometimes in the very same room, though not at the same time. For example, here on the left, we see a group of children beneath a tree examining the structure and environment of leaves. To the right, they bring those lessons indoors, diagram the leaves, and learn to sew from patterns created therefrom, bringing the real world into the classroom through hands-on lessons. In the center, a group of students learns to cook from a wood stove, another useful skill that can be carried outside the classroom. In Johnston's pictures, white students follow a similar pattern, here diagramming and drawing flowers they no doubt first studied outdoors. Older students study them in a lab setting. And for her pictures, Johnston creates elaborate backgrounds, utilizing statues, pictures, and especially the chalkboards, which feature drawings and carefully written phrases. These backgrounds occasionally belie her technique. A comparison of these two groups of students invites markedly different interpretations. The classroom is identical with the same chalk diagrams of cuts of pork and beef. So here's this pig and this pig. This diagram from the top. And then here you can see the tail of what I think is a cow over here. And then what the biggest giveaway is the piping of the wood stove, which you can see here. Only the positioning of the students, the first surrounding the wood burning stove and the second seated at a wooden table, is different. In reality, both groups of students may have learned identical skills, but for audiences in Paris, African Americans would become associated with the hot, difficult work of cooking at a wood stove with large tin pitchers and tubs, while white students would be connected to the refined porcelain and modern microscope seen here. By strategically positioning her subjects, Johnston tells divergent stories about education, labor, and womanhood while reinforcing extant expectations about where black and white bodies belong in society. Also in 1899, Johnston was invited to Hampton Normal and Agricultural Institute by its head of school, Reverend Hollis Burke Frizzell, whom she likely knew from the Cosmopolitan Club in Washington, D.C. Founded in the aftermath of the Civil War to educate freed men, the school emphasized the industrial arts. Frizzell agreed to Johnston's fee of $1,000, which is around $30,000 today, plus expenses and travel costs for her and her assistant in exchange for 158 by 10 negatives. She provided three prints of each, a set of duplicate negatives, and fulfilled requests for additional platinum prints. She spent all of December 1899 and part of January 1900 photographing Hampton, its facilities, its students, and rural areas and inhabitants nearby. As I stated before, the Hampton pictures are absolutely Johnston's best-known work, and if you know any examples, it's likely one of these two, the class in American history and students working on the treasurer's stairs. The pictures are endlessly fascinating with a blend of rigor and surprise that has sparked speculation since their reintroduction to the popular sphere in the 1960s. The Institute was coeducational and interracial, but hierarchical, with 700 African-American students, 200 Native American students, and 100 white staff and their families. Frizzell intended to use Johnston's photographs as publicity and fundraising aids to demonstrate the Hampton model's success. They would also be displayed at the Paris Exposition of 1900. Though implementing wildly repressive laws against African Americans and extreme violations of national sovereignty against Native Americans, the U.S. was eager to show an international audience that it was making progress in race relations. One of the defining features of the Hampton series is the juxtaposition of scenes that encapsulate an ethnographic present with definitions of the modern, always driving home the power of assimilation to civilize its students. Direct and vigorous arguments are made for the Hampton education through the improvement of material circumstances, such as in this pair of photographs. On the left, a couple from the older generation, likely born enslaved, are depicted eating a meager meal from a bare table before an exposed fireplace in a dim, postage stamp-sized cabin. In contrast, the spacious dining room of the Hampton graduate is light-filled and well-appointed. The neatly dressed family sits before a cloth-covered table set with fine china and glasses, exactly as the Hampton curriculum trained women to perform. Other details, such as the presence or lack of hair coverings, the refinement of cloth, and the clutter of household items, all convey ideas about class, cleanliness, and progress. These are before and after photographs, but also demonstrations of tangible outcomes with which any modern funder would be pleased. The treatment of Native Americans goes further, heavy-handedly tying Native dress and long hair to an uneducated status. Here, Johnston labels 7 Sioux children in traditional clothes as the offspring of uneducated parents. In contrast, the formal portrait of John Wheezy implies a potential outcome for these children, if only they would assimilate to Western dress and cultural expectations. For Johnston's progressive audiences, these types of comparisons held the underlying message that those populations they found most threatening, that they labeled savage, could be systematically made to conform to their notions of civilized. In his autobiography, Up From Slavery, Washington, a Hampton graduate himself summed it up this way, quote, "No white American ever thinks that any other race is wholly civilized until he wears the white man's clothes, eats the white man's food, speaks the white man's language, and professes the white man's religion," end quote. Desiring to demonstrate a narrow notion of progress for African Americans and Native Americans, Johnston accomplished this through a visualization and valorization of the conformity mandated from those who wished to be absorbed into America's body politic, perhaps best summarized by this mass of school children saluting the flag in the winter chill. Though the Tuskegee series is often oversimplified as a continuation of the Hampton series, there are extremely important differences. For example, Johnston created none of the comparison photographs of the impoverished or elderly that she did at Hampton. There are no figures depicted as uneducated or uncivilized at Tuskegee. And because Tuskegee had an all-black faculty, new visual opportunities presented themselves. Tuskegee had been founded through a charter from the state of Alabama, which allocated $2,000 for the salaries of teachers at an industrial school for black students that had no grounds, no buildings, and no books. Nothing one might expect at a school. Booker T. Washington, a Hampton graduate, was appointed to be its president, and the man in the institution quickly became synonymous as he built it from the ground up with the assistance of students and the community. Washington was born enslaved on a plantation in Hales Ford, Virginia in 1856, and after emancipation, he was forced to work in West Virginian mines to help support his family into his teenage years. In 1872, he arrived at Hampton with just 50 cents in his pocket. He could not afford tuition, let alone room and board, or even a second pair of socks, but the school allowed him to perform janitorial work in exchange for his education. He graduated in 1875, returned to Malden, West Virginia to teach, and then studied at Wayland Seminary here in Washington, D.C. In 1879, he returned to Hampton to administer the Native American dorms, which had only been formed the year before. In 1881, he was recommended by Hampton's founder, General Chapman, to head Tuskegee in Macon County, Alabama. Washington always referred to the Institute as his life's work. This is just a reminder that Washington's life's work was very dangerous. Barely a generation before, General O.O. Howard, head of the Freedmen's Bureau, gave this assessment, quote, "The opposition to Negro education made itself felt everywhere in a combination not to allow the freedmen any room or building in which a school might be taught. In 1865, 1866, and 1867, mobs of the baser classes at intervals and in all parts of the South occasionally burned school buildings and churches used as schools, flogged teachers or drove them away, and in a number of instances, murdered them," end quote. Washington enlisted political and economic support from Washington, D.C., and publicly prioritized industrial studies for African Americans while vastly expanding academic studies at Tuskegee. By commissioning Johnston and circulating a selection of her photographs, Washington reasserted Tuskegee's place in the marketplace of educational models. His immensely successful autobiography, Up From Slavery, was published unillustrated in 1900. But when it came time to write a follow-up, 1904's Working with the Hands, he included Johnston's photographs, including learning dressmaking. In 1903, he published an illustrated pamphlet, The Successful Training of the Negro, with 29 of Johnston's photographs. Already a formidable fundraiser with pledges from Andrew Carnegie and other wealthy Northern donors, Washington saw the opportunity to modernize his efforts and to offer his students up for inspection to those who supported them and those who did not. As she did for Hampton, Johnston produced mounted platinum prints similar to these examples from Harvard's collection. Some were likely bound into a presentation album for Washington to share with potential donors as he traveled from city to city. Learning dressmaking is a particularly strong entry point to the Tuskegee series. Washington pressed the issue of self-presentation often and made it a pillar of Tuskegee's culture. In Up From Slavery, he writes, quote, "For a long time, one of the most difficult tasks was to teach the students that all the buttons were to be kept on their clothes, and that there must be no torn places and no grease spots. This lesson, I am pleased to be able to say, has been so thoroughly learned and so faithfully handed down from year to year by one set of students to another that often at the present time, when the students march out of chapel in the evening and their dress is inspected, as it is every night, not one button is to be found missing," end quote. Johnston's photographs provide a kind of inspection too. Even when students work in the fields, or on a construction site, they are impeccably dressed, not a hair or shirt tail out of place. These are perfect students, diligent, quiet, and fastidiously presented. According to Washington's paradigm, graduates would model both their self-presentation and vocational training in their home communities, as well as provide the necessary products for their neighbors to attain these new standards of work and appearance. When Washington circulated the Tuskegee series, he chose photographs that emphasized this vision of the world, African Americans serving other African Americans, though in reality, it was very different. In learning dressmaking, 8 of the women worked directly with their hands, heads down in intense concentration to express the connection between the training they hold and its outward expression. The other 2 women, second from left here, and the central figure here, pose with their hands by their sides as dignified models for the students' work. In fact, they play the part of clients in this scenario, and importantly, they are Black clients. The women likely came to Tuskegee from rural districts, and many would have known formerly enslaved people firsthand. This is not a depiction of servitude, but rather of service to Black individuals and communities. Here, Washington's ultimate aspirations for Tuskegee's graduates are visualized and presented in Johnston's signature photographic style. In contrast, at Hampton, Johnston's photographs center Black and Indigenous figures, but white faculty appear as a source of authority and knowledge. In the Hampton dressmaking picture at right, a teacher demonstrates technique, while at left in the simple sewing class, a teacher stands at the head of the class with an example of work. The Tuskegee dressmaking picture, in contrast, lacks this embodied racial hierarchy and realizes a community in which African American women teach and assist one another. Even at Tuskegee, though, Johnston could not completely escape the intrusion of racial hierarchies. In millinery, an advanced class only open to women who had mastered sewing and dressmaking, the idea of a white clientele permeates the picture. Seated at their desk, these 11 students have the same expressions of concentration as their colleagues in learning dressmaking, only in this scene, their prospective clients are not their fellow classmates, but rather the eerily disembodied 3 Gibson girl busts that punctuate the composition. So here's 1, 2, and 3. The youngest representation of a white client is fully centered in the composition and appears to be the only figure that looks into the camera. It is an eerily proto-surrealist compositional choice by Johnston. Washington never published it, even though it depicted some of his most advanced students. Unlike learning dressmaking, this composition seemingly reinscribes the status quo rather than imagining a new social order formed by Tuskegee graduates serving their own communities as exemplars of a newly imagined American citizen. Washington consistently chose to circulate photographs that visualized his worldview of Black excellence in service to Black communities. In all, Washington circulated about 1/5 of the photographs Johnston created. He concentrated on those that showed students amidst the Institute's grounds, working with their hands. In building the roof, working men seem almost at one with the structure they have erected and in which they will learn. They appear almost as the conjuring of the two men at lower left, who study plans drawn up by students. In working in the field, students are positioned in a careful pattern with their tools as they gather crops they have grown and they have studied in depth. At the same time, Washington excluded images of students pursuing purely academic studies without concrete application. He carefully honed the image of Tuskegee as a place that connected students to the practical needs of their communities and their collective advancement, as he defined it. Washington tied the prosperity of the South directly to education and citizenship of African Americans, imploring those, quote, who look to the incoming of those of foreign birth and strange tongue and habits for the prosperity of the South, cast down your bucket where you are. Cast it down among the 8 million of Negroes whose habits you know, whose fidelity and love you have tested. In all things that are purely social, we can be as separate as the fingers, yet one as the hand in all things essential to mutual progress, end quote. In the midst of the codification of Plessy versus Ferguson, Washington visualized a model citizen that inhabited a separate but prosperous world. Because this is a work in progress, and my next steps for this project are to attempt to amass all 150 photographs, it's estimated Johnston made at Tuskegee, and to identify the students featured through school records, and to better understand Washington's photographic selection so that I may further center his intentions for the pictures. I welcome your thoughts on these pictures as well. Thank you very much.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.